Dr. Raymond Moody is my guest. In a moment, we're going to jump into near-death experiences as reported by kids. And some of those are pretty profound. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines with your calls and questions. I'm hoping that some people who've had near-death experiences themselves will call in and share those experiences with us and with Dr. Moody. We'll be right back. Dr. Moody, because of your books, the latest one, by the way, The Light Beyond, Explorations into the Afterlife, you know, the whole world knows basically the essential steps that constitute a near-death experience, you know, rising out of your body and seeing yourself laying down there, the doctors, you know, trying to do some work, floating around to other locations beyond where your body is, going through a tunnel, meeting dead relatives and loved ones, you know, the review of the life, the supreme being, and then a reluctance to come back. People don't want to come back. It's so blissful over there. And before we get into specific cases of kids and NDEs, I want to ask you about the bliss, because, I guess blissful could be great in measured doses, but I'm thinking to myself, what do you do in all that bliss? You got hot and cold running bliss, 24/7 bliss. How do you pass the time? Because that I think I could see myself looking at my watch.
Yeah, well, except there is no time, right? It's you and I are accustomed to being oriented to time and place. And the matter of fact, in the psychiatric mental status exam, that's the first thing you ask is you see if the patient is oriented to time, if they can tell you what day it is, what time it is, and where they are. But when people go into this other state of existence, what they say is that it doesn't operate by space and time, but it's more like love and information, is how I heard my friend Dr. Eben Alexander describe it a few years ago. So it doesn't work on time and space. And people will tell you, for example, that if you have a question, it's automatic that the knowledge appears just by your requesting it. And in effect, that used to sound so weird back in the late 60s and early 70s when I was first talking with lots and lots of people who had this. But now with the internet, it doesn't sound nearly as strange as it used to. Right.
I guess my question would be more like, okay, time doesn't matter. You got all the time there is. Time doesn't exist, and you've got all the knowledge you need. What do you do with it? If we're talking about sort of the near-death experiences giving us a glimpse into what our purpose might be in this life, what's the purpose of that one if it's just bliss all the time? Are you painting? Are you writing?
I don't know. And it's also very difficult for people to put this into words. And matter of fact, that's probably the most common thing that people with near-death experiences say, is that no matter how articulate they may be or how many degrees or languages they speak, they say there are no words for this, and that you are into an entirely different framework of existence. It's like waking up from a dream. You know, like in the morning when you're waking up from a dream, you're trying to hold on to those bizarre images, and it's quickly receding. That's the same thing people say when they almost die, except the dream is this world we're in now. And people will say as soon as they're out of their body, they lose interest in their physical body. They may not even recognize that body as themselves. But they quickly become aware of this entirely different realm of existence that is sort of suffused with love and information. You're in an entirely different framework of existence.
You write in this new book, the parts of it that I've read, about what happens to us as individuals, what happens to our core identity? I guess, you know, in some of the descriptions, we're sort of absorbed into the whole with all the other souls or consciousness. But what happens to us as people? Because if we, you know, as individuals, if we don't know it's us, I don't know if it's as blissful as it could be.
How old are you now, George?
I'm 65.
65. In a few more years, you're going to be. I'm 74 now. And I don't know if you've reached this point yet, but in a few years you'll be able to. This is the way I put it. I say, I am sick of Raymond Moody. I really am. And when I'm lecturing and I say that, I see people my age, you can see them kind of nodding, right? But young people look at that and they're horror, they're just thinking, he must be depressed, right? But individuality would be a bore. To me, it's a horrible thought that I would have to be Raymond Moody for eternity, right? And the way I have come to think of it, and this comes from my thoughts about this come from my two adopted kids, both adopted at birth. And I was already in my 50s when they came along, and so you're more observant. And and I should also tell you, believe it or not, that my wife and I don't talk about life after death. We talk about the phone bill, what's for dinner, what's on at the movies, right? Plus, we don't take our kids to religious ceremonies. I live in Alabama, and I'm afraid of snakes. And, so we don't take them to church things, right? So, a matter of fact, they found out a few years ago about my book, Life After Life, from reading about me on the Internet. Huh. But both of my kids, adopted kids, have related very vivid memories of where they were before they came to us, but just spontaneously. And Carter, especially, Carter is now 20, but when he was very little, he and I were sitting on the bed watching TV, and I flipped through a channel, which turned out to be the National Geographic channel, but as I did, Carter became very animated. And he said, Dad, that's my village. I said, what? So I turned it back, and it was a documentary about village life in China. And he started jabbering away. He said, yeah. Before I came to you and Mommy, I was with my other mom and dad and my brothers and sisters in China. And I was just astonished. I'm sure my mouth was hanging open. And he saw immediately that I wasn't computing. And so, as though to orient me, he said, yeah. And then I was up in the trees looking at you and Mommy lying in the grass. And George, I knew exactly what he was talking about. Because before he came along, my wife and I were in Greece. And we were at an archaeological site, and we were exhausted from the flight. And so the attendant, picking up on that, and there was nobody else there, so he said, just go over there in the grass and lie down and take a nap. And there were these big trees all around, and what we were talking about was adopting a baby.
Wow.
And similarly, I have a Native American daughter, again, adopted at birth. And when she was about six, it's so funny having a Native American kid because you see the role of genetics. Like, she's Blackfeet, and the Blackfeet women for 20,000 years were the gatherers, right? Well, she fell right into this, and she started taking these long walks with me when she was just 3 years old and carried what she called her nature bag and an incredible ability to see birds' nests. And, just obviously, that's because, just for 20,000 years, that's what the women in her tribe did. And so on one of these walks, she was this old wooden bridge. She loved to stop there and talk. And just out of nowhere, she said, I don't like this place. And it was plain to me that what she was talking about was this world. So again, I was startled, and she went on to say, she said, yeah, she said, you know, when you die, you just go up and you be with God, and he holds you up there, she said, until all the people you've known while you are alive have died, and then he sends you back as another person. And I was startled. I said, well, what makes you think? And with the tips of her fingers on both hands, she pointed, pointing at her eyes. She said, I just know. She said, I just know. And she said, and I was with God, and he pointed you out to me. And he said, you got to go down to be his daughter. Wow. And I said, well, you know, how did you feel about that? And she said, oh, I didn't want to do it. She said, I wanted to stay with my Gotti. But she said, and she put both hands out in front of her pushing. And she said, but he pushed me down. She did it two times, pushed me down to be his daughter. To be your daughter. And I said, well, are you glad you came anyway? And she said, yeah. But in both cases, I didn't really ask it. I just let them talk. Because, you know, if you think if you ask something, then you stand the risk of shaping it. But partly because of that, both of them still remember these. And once in a while, they bring it up. Yeah.
Can you share any specific or maybe more than one NDEs involving kids that have been investigated by you or reported by your colleagues that sort of indicate that this is for real, that these kids weren't coached, that they didn't see this on a TV show, that they actually did leave their bodies?
Yes, I can, George. And at the same time, I'm not the expert on this, but on January 8th, at the site that we mentioned earlier, theuniversityofheaven.com is what it's called. And on January 8th, we're having Dr. Melvin Morse, who is a pediatrician who studied near-death experiences. So if you go to that website and look this up, and it will be very interesting because Melvin Morse has had a really amazing events in his life. So we'll be talking about this whole thing. But so January 8th at theuniversityofheaven.com. And meanwhile, yes, I have talked to kids. I was not a pediatrician, but psychiatry was my field, and specifically I was forensic psychiatry. I worked in a maximum security unit for the criminally insane with some serial killers and mass murderers and mainly paranoid schizophrenic killers. So didn't have much pediatric experience. But yes, over the years I have talked with lots of people who had these their near-death experiences as kids, or sometimes it would just I talked to very young kids. Before there was much publicity on my work on near-death experiences, I was a medical student and taking my pediatrics rotation. And I was in the clinic one day and had this kid who was 11 years old who had what we call congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which is a endocrine disorder, a congenital adrenal disorder. And so I was just examining the kid, but just suddenly he changed demeanor. A switch went off and he went into a different kind of state. And he said, and you know, doctor, a year ago, he said, I had a crisis and I died. And then he related this near-death experience to me. Well, obviously, I had his chart right there in the room with me. And so I looked back, and sure enough, just about a year before, these patients have periodic crises in which they get very sick. And so there it was, right in the medical record, that he, and he was talking about being lifted up and seeing these spiritual entities all around him and so on. And then another time back in the early 80s, my son Samuel at that time was in the, I think, third or fourth grade. And so one of the kids in the class had a near-death experience. And so the teacher asked me to come to talk to the kids about this. And the young girl talked about it too. And I noticed with her, as I have very often with these kids who have near-death experiences, seem to me mature beyond their age. I remember talking to this young girl there. It was just like talking with an adult, because it seems to bring about this very quick maturing process. So it is startling to see the effects that it has. I'm in Savannah, Georgia once. I interviewed this man who was the manager of a restaurant. And so I went to the restaurant to interview him, actually. But he was telling me about his near-death experience, which took place, again, I believe, when he was 11. And he talked about what the experience was like for him as a kid. But he went on to say that throughout his life, that this experience sort of stayed with him. And he was describing a specific event in which he was in his business. A gun was held to his hand, to his head. And this was when he was already an adult. But he was talking about the feelings he had during that event, was that he went back to his near-death experience and it was okay with him, that, you know, that he just wasn't scared and having the gun held to his hand, so to his head. So these near-death experiences of kids really do have lasting effects.
The stories that are most persuasive to me are the ones where the people who leave their bodies access information that they could not have obtained otherwise. They float above their bodies. They see things from a vantage point that it must be true that they were actually out and floating around.
Well, yes, I have plenty cases like that where patients will tell you that they saw things while they were out of their body that from our perspective they couldn't have seen because they were out of view of the person and so on. A nurse, for example, was in a resuscitation, told me that when she was involved in this resuscitation and she went into another room, all out of the room where she was being, the woman was being resuscitated. And in her haste, she took one of the little vials that you pop the glass neck of it off, and because they were just hurried to try to resuscitate this woman. And so then she ran back into the resuscitation room. But she said after the woman was revived and was talking to her, she said, the woman said to her, she said, "Honey, I saw you pop the neck off that bottle, and you shouldn't have done that. You could have cut yourself." And, you know,
Dr. Moody, we're going to have to take a break now. I'm sorry to interrupt. We'll finish that story on the other side and then take some calls from our listeners, hopefully with their own NDE stories. We're talking with Dr. Raymond Moody about near-death experiences, his research into them. And in a moment, we open up the phone lines with your calls and questions and maybe your experiences as well. We'll be right back. Dr. Moody, did you want to continue the story, or were you about finished with that one?
I think I was finished with that. Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to ask you this. Over the break, I got a message, an email from one of our listeners that said, don't worry about all that bliss, George, because unless you're a good Catholic, you're going to go straight to hell and burn forever, and they're not going to have to worry about bliss, which I hope that was sort of tongue-in-cheek and not intentionally meant that way, literally, but you do cross lines of religious faiths. There are a lot of commonalities, but a lot of divisions there. Do you get that kind of a reaction that your
well,
vision?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, George. I hear all the time that, oh, poor Moody, Dr. Moody was tormented by the medical community. They thought he was nuts and so on. And that's a wonderful story, and I almost wish it were true because I do have a little bit of a martyr complex. But in reality, George, it was just not true. I had been researching this 10 years when I went to medical school in 1972, and so there was already some information about it. I had friends who were in medical school ahead of me who had told my professors I was coming, and so within the first 2 weeks of medical school, 8 professors called me up and told me either about their own experiences or about experiences they had heard from their patients, and they were very supportive when I was in medical school. But the reaction that I got, and not being a religious person, it suddenly startled me, was that I began to get all these letters from fundamentalists who are saying, oh, this is of the devil, and so on. And so, that kind of fundamentalist mindset, there's a certain kind of person who is just terrified to say 3 words, which I find very easy to say, is, I don't know. And there's a certain kind of people who've got to have an ideology that whatever answer comes up, they can kind of crank it out, like from a machine. And that's just the psychological condition. It doesn't have anything to do with God.
I think that the work that you've done and that you have shared with the world, you and others, is a source of comfort for people, both the people who are terminal and who learn about this and they've got something to look forward to and encouragement, and then also their families dealing with grief.
Right. People who've lost their loved ones and or people who've had near-death experiences, and they're happy that that to know that other people have had them as well. So religion, I'm not much on religion. I tell you the truth. It's I like to say that I talk to God every day, and he's never said a word to me about religion, I think.
Let's take some calls. On the international line, we have Wolf in Vancouver, British Columbia. Hi, Wolf.
Oh. How you doing?
Hi, what's on your mind?
You guys said to call in if I had a near-death experience. Well, I did have one when I was 15. It wasn't drug or alcohol-induced, so I'll just make that clear. But it's not important to get in how I died, but... 1 minute I was here, and next minute I wasn't here. I was actually almost like what they say on television, you're in an area of pure fog. And I didn't know that I was dead. I just felt funny and kind of happy, right, that I was there where I was. I started seeing 2 figures walking from the mist coming towards me. And before they could come to me, there was hands on the back of my shoulders. And I couldn't see the hands, and there was no speaking. But I was let to be known that I shouldn't be there. And I got really upset. Like, I was like, and I don't want to go. I'm happy here. And I said, I don't want to go to hell. And that was the very first thing that ever came to my mind was, I'm going to go to hell because that's what I was taught, right? And I was let to be known that there's no such place as hell, that any deed we do that happens to us, like, say, we're good to somebody or we're bad to somebody. When we're good to somebody, no problem, right? We get to see it in our life review. We become that person, and we get to feel what they felt when they were happy with what we did. If we're mean to that person, we feel that exact same thing too.
But, did it change you, Wolf? Did it change you when you came back?
Well, yes. I was so young, though. When I came back, it didn't really feel anything different. I was more, the situation was I was stuck somewhere, and I had to escape from it, right? So anyway, I had to be rescued. But anyway, from that point there, I was just all of a sudden pushed down through a dark tunnel, and the tunnel went down really fast, and I could feel, like, not really a wind, but I could hear the whooshing of me going down. There was a little bright light at the very end of it, and when I entered in the bright light, I slammed back into the body, and I sat up, and I was like, like this, right?
Let me get a reaction from Dr. Moody to the story so far. Raymond, the part he says about he didn't really want to go back, you hear that a lot. In this book, The Light Beyond, you report that people come back, they're in their bodies, they're angry. They're angry at their doctors for bringing them back.
That's right, just like our caller is saying. And also that that the part that he said that he was told he wasn't supposed to be there. Yeah, I hear that all the time, too. People say that they said, I had to go back, that I wasn't ready to be there yet, that I had things left to do, is what you hear from people all the time.
First-time caller, Harry in Denver. Hi, Harry. Good morning.
Yes, hello.
Hi. Well, so you're going to share your story with us?
Yeah, I when I was in college, this is about 50 years ago, I rented a motorcycle, and I drove up into the mountains from Boulder. I was going to see you at the time. And I got up near Gross Reservoir, and there's a train track that goes from Denver to Winter Park. And I got on the train tracks to go back down, and I got in a tunnel with a train coming at me.
Oh, my God.
And I
swear, why don't we skip to the part where, so you got it, did you get hit by the train?
No, but it came within inches of my handlebars. And the only way I can explain that I wasn't killed is that I had some kind of guardian angel looking out after me.
So you didn't actually leave your body. This is just a close call.
No.
You know, I hear this a lot, too, where people will say that they are in situations where they should have died, and it's just at the last minute they feel that they... sometimes people say that they think that there's a person there. You say a guardian angel. Yeah, this is one way it's described, or that there is a person there, sometimes a voice that that rescues them. I have a friend who's a neighbor of mine, actually, who some years ago he was working in a factory, and a 2,000-pound crate of window parts fell on him, directly on him, and he said, oh, you know, this is it. Matter of fact, in the accident, his face was torn off, and which is to avoid creating an anxiety attack in anybody. I'll tell you that it worked out okay. The plastic surgeon was able to reattach his face, and you can't even tell, but just a horrific accident. But he said that he was thinking, you know, I'm dead, but he said the most compassionate and sweet voice that he had ever heard said, no, you're not, just stand up. So he stood up, but really the doctors involved said there's no way he could have stood up, but everybody saw him stand up. So things do happen sometimes at the point of death where people feel that they are even though they live or sometimes not even very badly injured, but nonetheless feel that a helping figure is there with them to help them through this.
Sort of an intervention to stop the whole near-death experience from happening.
That's right.
Shortcut. Wildcard line, Daniel in St. Louis. Good morning, Daniel. Hello, Daniel.
Hey, I'm here.
Hi.
Actually, it's an honor that you're taking my call. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and just wanted to put that out there. So I think some of the things that you guys are talking about is about that, you know, those unique experiences or like the other side, beyond the veil, or, you know, so many different ways to describe that experience. And people will actively work towards this goal through, I think, our tried and true method. So Kundalini Yoga, I have no idea what a Kundalini experience is, but it's very well described. Meditation, astral projection, which is something that I've tried. Wasn't very good at it, but I guess it's just like mysticism in general and following a certain spiritual process. really, like, it's just unclear what the methods are, you know.
Well, let's ask Dr. Moody about it. Dr. Moody, can you sort of acclimate yourself to this, prepare for it? There's an article that we posted on the Coast website about some Buddhists who meditate quite a bit, who can get out of body experiences, not quite the same as near death, but can simulate sort of that or put you on the path to it through training and experience.
Yes, there are various ways. And the one that I have always been interested in since the age of 18 is philosophy. Plato said that philosophy is a rehearsal for dying. And I remember reading that as I was 18, and I really related to it. And now, as a 74-year-old psychiatrist, I'm astonished that an 18-year-old would pick up on that so, vigorously as I did. And I think if you continue to think and reflect about death all your life, then when the time comes, it's just part of life. And in terms of getting out of your body without having to be near death, there are ways to do that, and sometimes it happens spontaneously. For example, musicians who are playing great music on stage will sometimes say that they are projected out of their body. I have a friend, Eric Pagani, who is a well-known psychologist in France and also concert pianist. And years ago, Eric was telling me that he was playing a concert, and in the midst of the music, he left his body and went into this light. And 17 minutes later, he came back and was sitting at the keyboard, and he had played three pieces. And Eric is a very modest person. Matter of fact, Eric is one of the sweetest people I've ever known in my life. He's very modest. And I said, well, did the people seem to like the music? And he very modestly said, well, yes, they seemed to. Fortunately, his sister was there, and she had been at the concert. And she said, as a matter of fact, people were jumping up and down and yelling and screaming, resounding applause. But he said, then, being a psychologist, he said, well, if this has happened to me, it's happened to others. So he interviewed a lot of his friends who were operatic singers and so on, who said the same thing, that during great music, that they leave their body and they watch it from up above. Astronomers looking through their telescopes sometimes have out-of-body experiences. Or the caller mentioned mystical experience, and people who are out in the woods, for example, in scenes of great beauty will sometimes have mystical experiences or out-of-body experiences. So you don't have to be near death to have an out-of-body experience.
We'll try to get one more call in. West of the Rockies, Christian in San Pedro. Hey, Christian, what happened to you?
Hi, how you guys doing? I'll relate my story, but like I said, I was taking care of my stepfather, who he was dying of prostate and metastatic bone cancer. I was his caregiver. To make a long story short, I noticed in the final 6 months that there was a spiritual presence. I don't know who or what it was, whether a family member, I don't know, that I felt that I was not alone. And I was by his bedside, my uncle's bedside, He just had a few hours to live. It was me in his bedroom and a caregiver, a nurse. I've never had an experience like this before, but I can say that in the final hours of his life on Earth, that I don't know who or what it was, but the spiritual entity came into his bedroom. And I'll tell you something. You have a lot of those, as you mentioned, fire and brimstone people who think they know God, and, you know, and of the hardline Catholic Christian faith or the Baptist, and, you know, if you're gay, you'll go to hell, or, you know, this or that. And I can say right now for a fact that they're wrong. To me, God or Jesus or whoever you want to call it, the spiritual entity, that when I was by my uncle's bedside as he was dying, that to me, God is very loving, very understanding, and above all, very forgiving.
Well, I tell you what, Christian, we have about a minute left, so I'm going to get Dr. Moody's final comments here. Dr. Moody, is that sort of the general sense that you get looking at the big picture of these near-death experiences, that we're all bound for that place? Because I know in some of your previous writings, you do get occasional glimpses of something that sounds like hell. We got like a minute.
Yeah, it's very rare once in a while. However, the hellish near-death experiences, George, are a lot more variegated. There are fewer of them. And also, a lot of the ones I've talked to, small percentage, but over the years, maybe a few dozen people, but very often they sound more like delirium because they're very surrealistically distorted. But I would agree with the caller, and what he was saying there was that he sensed this spiritual presence or saw it. And I just hear that all the time. People, I heard it. First one I heard was from one of my the nurses on the GYN ward when I was a student going through that rotation. And she and I developed a good relationship. And one night she came into the nursing station and she said, "Raymond, Mrs. So-and-so back there is going to die tonight or tomorrow." And I said, "Well, what makes you think so?" And she said, "Well, I just opened the door in there and I saw an apparition standing beside her bed." And you know, this is just a very, very common thing. It's
Dr. Raymond Moody, we're out of time. On that comforting note, I want to thank you for coming back. I hope people will check out your newest book, The Light Beyond, and also Life After Life Institute and University of Heaven. You're welcome here anytime. I hope you'll come back and share some new research with us.
Would love to anytime, George. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much. And coming up next, Eric Wargo talking about time loops, very consistent with our subject matter tonight.